You're listening to another episode of the Young Investors Podcast, so sit back and relax as myself, Brandon, and my buddy Hamish discuss the latest in the world of finance and stock market investing. Now, a quick reminder before we get into the podcast is that nothing in this podcast should be taken on as personal financial advice. If you're ever unsure about your finances or investing and you need some help, make sure you reach out to a qualified financial advisor. But with all that said, let's get into another episode of the Young Investors Podcast.
Welcome back, everybody. Welcome back, Brandon. How are you doing on this fine Thursday morning?
I'm not, what a fine morning it is.
I've just revealed the day that we record the podcast on.
Yeah, we say that all the time, though. We record on Thursday.
I was just kidding.
Oh no, people are going to hack our credit cards now that they know that we record on
security question. What day do you record the Young Investors Podcast?
That's great. I'm doing well. I'm doing well. How are you going?
Yeah, going well. It's going well. It's been an eventful week. In the markets, I guess, a little bit.
It has.
Yeah, we've had a big annual meeting that I'm sure a lot of people are aware that that occurred. But yeah, I mean, besides that, I've been continuing to look for houses, look for a new studio space. Mm. Still
How's
on the
it
hunt.
Going?
Yeah, it's going okay. It's difficult. I'm very picky. Yeah. I've discovered, so
fair.
I have to look at a lot of places and yeah, it is. I mean, it is tricky. Like we're talking about just off the podcast, it's tricky because we want to have a big enough space to set up a recording studio and maybe something else like a podcast studio or something. So it's not exactly it's not common for there to be a big bedroom space for that or a big area for that in a small house. So
yeah, you need like an American style ranch, big bedrooms. The ranch. Dr. Phil.
Yeah.
Send you to the ranch. But yeah, hopefully you find something. But yeah, it's so true. Like most townhouses or apartments that have been built in the last little while, they've got a decent sized master bedroom. And then as soon as you get away from the master, you go to the second or third bedroom. It's just so tiny. It feels like flipping 2 meters by 2 meters. They're so small. It's like I could almost lay down and I'd be the length of the room.
Yeah. I mean, ideally we would have either a 2-bedroom house that was the same size as a 3-bedroom, but just had 2 big bedrooms, but that is so rare because it just doesn't really make any economic sense if you're leasing out a property to have 2 really big bedrooms. It makes more sense to up it to a 3-bedroom, even if they're small, because you can obviously charge more if you're able to rent it out to more people if you have those 3 bedrooms. So, yeah.
So, if you live in Melbourne and you happen to have a property that has that you're renting out with big bedrooms, Hamish wants to.
If you're in the eastern suburbs and you have a.
You can call Hamish on 04.
Oh, dear.
All right. Well, let's get stuck into it, hey? We've got so much to talk about.
Yeah.
We should probably not dilly-dally too much.
Mm.
We got even more to talk about today because last week we had to cut short. So, we've really piled it on this week.
Yeah.
And there was even just this week, there was a lot of news. So I guess we should probably get stuck into it.
Yeah, absolutely. So today's episode is sponsored by ShareSite, which is an application that you can use to track the performance of your stock portfolio. So basically, it will allow you to enter in all of your trades. You can either do it manually, or if your broker is one of the associated brokers, you can just integrate it straight in and it will just port all of your trades over immediately as you do them. And it will allow you to track accurately all of the different types of gains that you experience. So capital gains, dividends. If you have dividend reinvestment plans, then it will do all of those calculations for you. And then currency gains, if you're buying shares internationally or you hold foreign currencies, which is a lifesaver, particularly if you're buying shares internationally, as I said, because otherwise it's pretty much impossible to track currency gains if you're not doing it with a piece of software or a spreadsheet, but doing it with a spreadsheet would be a pain. So being able to do that through ShareSite is a lifesaver. And then you can also use it for when it comes to tax time. So ShareSite generates up to 10 different reports that can be used at tax time to work out things such as your capital gains, dividend income, and more. And at the moment, you can try ShareSite for free by heading over to ShareSite.com/Young Investors. That's site spelled SIGHT, ShareSite.com/Young Investors. And if you use that link, you can also get 4 months free or 4 months off when you sign up to a yearly subscription. So go check it out if you're interested.
Such a good deal. Such a good deal. I actually finally decided to take all of my stuff and actually import it on ShareSite. So I'm now 100% invested in ShareSite.
Oh, wow. Very good.
Yeah. I finally got all my stuff across and figured it out. And Yeah, far out. It is a lifesaver. It is, well, it is going to be a lifesaver. It's such a good program. I mean, it looks, at this point in time in 2021, the aesthetic of the site is slightly dated, but man, in terms of functionality, like it is so good. Just being able to, like what you just said in the ad, just track everything is so goddamn helpful.
Yeah.
But anyway, let's move on. We better start with Berkshire.
We have to start with this.
There's no way we couldn't start with this. So, yeah, Saturday, 1st of May, the Berkshire Hathaway annual shareholder meeting was conducted in Los Angeles. So, Berkshire Hathaway CEO Warren Buffett, he sat down with Charlie Munger and Ajit Jain and Greg Abel. And, you know, it's supposed to be like a shareholder meeting, but really it's just a Q&A session. That's really all it is.
Yeah, they spend very little time talking about Berkshire's actual businesses. Mm. It's like the value investor Super Bowl.
Basically, yeah, that's a good way of putting it. It definitely is like that. They spend like 15 minutes on the actual shareholder meeting stuff, and then it's like 3.5-4 hours of just question answering by the world's best investors, Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger. So it's a very, very good event to tune into if you are a follower of the Warren Buffett kind of value investing strategy. And I did sit through the whole thing. Hamish, you're almost through the whole thing. So I wanted to talk about, do a bit of a summary and talk about some of the points that came up during that that Q&A session. Well, first of all, we should actually start at the start. Warren Buffett of recent years, he started out the session by almost doing like a little lecture for investors, which I think is really cool because it just helps you, you know, what's Warren Buffett really wanting to tell us? And this year, he actually started with a lecture for new investors. So, he aimed it at people that have just gotten into the market over, say, the last 12 months or so. And there were two main points that he wanted to convey. The first one is that picking stocks is actually quite hard. So, even though it seems like it's easy at the moment because you can basically pick anything and in a week or two you've made money, picking stocks is actually very difficult. That's the first thing. And he also brought up the point that it's not just about being in the right industry. That seems to be a trend at the moment. You know, people are getting in on what's popular, whether it be Bitcoin or electric vehicles, batteries, artificial intelligence. He's saying it's not enough to just be in the right industry. So, they're the two main points. I wanted to start with the way he described the first point, you know, the idea that picking stocks is actually quite difficult. He showed the largest 20 companies in the world that were, in the world back in 1989. And then he compared it to the largest 20 companies today. And what was really interesting is that not a single one of those companies, those top 20 global companies in 1989, featured on the 2021 list. How crazy is that? Not a single company.
Yeah, it's crazy, right? When he basically made it like a bit of a game, like guess how many of these companies do you think were still around? What is that, 30 years ago, is it? Yeah, 30 years ago.
Yeah, it's like 32,
32 years ago. And you had to kind of guess like, well, how many of these would have been in the top 20? And it was none of them, which was amazing. And the other amazing thing was during that period, there was only a few American companies in the top 20. It was mostly Japanese companies as well. Japan was going through that massive boom during that period. And since then, the Japanese market, I think it's still down from where it was up in the 80s. So, that was really a peak time for Japan in terms of the stock market. But yeah, fascinating to see that not a single company was still in the top 20.
And he used that to say, look, okay, so if you're investing here and you're thinking, oh, I'll pick Facebook or I'll pick Google or I'll pick Apple, you could be thinking, oh, there's no way these companies are ever going out of existence. And you might be right on one of them, but if you look back in history, the chances are most of those companies will be largely irrelevant in 20 years from now, or 30 years from now, rather. Yeah. So, he kind of said, look, picking stocks is hard. But he also made the example that while picking individual stocks is hard, it's also important, like being in the stock market is definitely the right thing to do for a long-term investor. Like if you're going to put your money somewhere, put it, you know, get it into the stock market, even though picking stocks is hard, because he, on that same chart, he showed that the most valuable company in the world via stock valuation went from $100 billion back in 1989 to $2 trillion. In 2021, obviously. And then the 20th, so the last stock on that list, the 20th most valuable company of 1989 went from $30 billion to today it sits at $300 billion. So he kind of used that as an example. While all those companies themselves changed, look at, you know, the largest companies in the world have still grown, like the market capitalization has still gone up like heaps. So stocks are definitely the right place to be. And then he brings it back to the idea of, you know, the way that you can still get that success without having to pick individual stocks is through index funds and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that just blew me away, because it's so hard to believe that the largest company could go 20x, or the size of the largest company could go 20x over a 30-year period. Obviously, it wasn't the same company, but the scale of the market just increased massively over that period. And obviously, a significant driver of that through that period was probably computing and then also the internet. Both of those things have just allowed businesses to be massively more productive than they were previously. Yeah. And that's even more evidenced by the fact that all of the largest businesses, or most of the largest businesses today that are experiencing those $1 trillion valuations, are tech companies that are capitalizing on the internet or computing that has advanced massively. So it's fascinating to see. And Buffett didn't kind of make any predictions for the future, but it's almost certain that we will see, well, not certain, but it's probably very, very likely that we will see, you know, a $10 trillion company in our lifetime, or a $20 trillion company in our lifetime, which is hard to believe, maybe even more than that. I mean, going at the same rate, you know, in 30 years that you would expect a $20 to $40 trillion company. And maybe it's not going to be at the same rate, but over 60, 70 years, we're definitely going to see that, or it's very likely we're going to see that. So it's hard to imagine, but businesses as a group, I mean, if they have the ability to invest capital freely and businesses innovate, it's an amazing thing how much value can actually be created over time.
Yep, absolutely. Can you imagine being alive when there's a $20 or $30 or $40 trillion company? That's just insane. I mean, people already, Warren Buffett raised this, a little bit numb to numbers. It's like there's a certain number of zeros that people just no longer can really understand, like the scale of that number. So just like even $2 trillion, I'm like, what the hell? Like that is insane.
Yeah.
But Matt, yeah, like 10, 20 trillion. Oh my gosh, that would just be ridiculous.
I mean, we have individual people that have a bigger net worth than the value of companies in the 80s, which is crazy, because you could, it would be insane to imagine someone having $1 trillion value, like an individual having $1 trillion dollar net worth, but it's going to happen. And it probably won't take that long to happen.
Yeah.
Particularly, it's very strange.
It is strange.
But it is a good lesson. The two things he kind of showed, it's kind of that on an individual business basis, it's very, very challenging. But on a broad business basis, this has been what's consistently happened. The market goes up and it's a different composite. Yeah. But if you're buying a group of them and you're buying,
it doesn't matter,
and you're constantly buying the biggest group of them, then it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly right. Yep. So that was his first lesson. And then the second lesson, as I said before, is that it's not just about being in the right industry. So people are just, you know, buying whatever they can, Bitcoin, AI, electric vehicle companies, like whatever. And they'll just, oh, you know, I'm in the right industry, you know, lithium miners, because, you know, lithium goes into batteries. Mm. So he drew back to the example of, you know, the car. And back in the early kind of 1900s, it became clear that the car was the way of the future, and that that was going to be a really big industry. But so much so that everybody started opening their own car companies. So at one point he was saying there was over 2000 American auto companies back in, you know, 1910, 2030. I don't quite know the exact timeline. But then he drew the example to, okay, so cars were this massive industry. So surely those American auto companies would have done quite well. You know, they capitalized, they were early and they got into this booming industry and it continued to boom and it still booms today. You know, people, you know, look out the window and you can probably see a lot of cars. But in 2008, only three American car companies were still going. And in the GFC, two of them went bust. So of the big America, because people immediately say, what about Tesla? Tesla survived. But of the big, at the time, big American car companies, only two of them survived. Only one of them survived, rather. Two of them went bust. So it's, yeah. He basically said, if you picked Ford, then congratulations. But if you picked any of the other 1,000, however many companies, then nah. You got wiped out at some stage.
Yeah, I think this story was probably more interesting to me as well. I just found it. I mean, I knew it was true, and this is it's like something that you know is true, but to see yeah. it, to see an example of it that's so dramatic is kind of amazing, because the vast majority of, he pulled up a slide of some of the lifetimes of some auto companies. And he pulled up a slide and he was going to pull up a slide of all of the auto companies that started with the letter M and show their lifetime, but he couldn't even fit them all in the slide. So he did MA, I think it was. And yeah. it filled the right. entire slide. And all of these companies were like 1905 to 1907, 1905 yeah. to 1912, 1912 to 1930. Like it was yeah. all of these companies that had started in this industry, and the vast majority of them were duds.
Exactly.
And it's a very, very good example of how challenging it is to invest in brand new industries, because no one just knows who's going to be the dominant force in that industry. And it makes a lot more sense to invest in businesses, either just invest broadly, which is what the vast majority of people should probably be doing. But if you are going to invest in individual businesses, pick ones that have already got a proven track record, have already established yeah. themselves in the market, and pick industries that are not extremely challenging, like the auto industry.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, that's right. So that was really his first section of the Q&A of the annual shareholder meeting. It's just this lesson that he wanted to give, and then after that just launched straight into Q&A. Now we won't go through everything because we'd be here for hours, but I'll pick out some of the interesting thing. I think the biggest takeaway point was when he was speaking about interest rates and when he was talking about inflation. I think that's probably the biggest takeaway from this Q&A section, and also, you know, stuff about what he's doing with, you know, how he's holding on to cash and how he's, you know, when the stock market crashed last year, the only thing he was comfortable buying was, you know, Berkshire Hathaway shares. So anyway, but starting at the start, so he spoke a lot about interest rates and inflation. So on interest rates, he said, interest rates are to the value of assets what gravity is to matter. So obviously what he means by that is, you know, if rates are low, it's like low gravity. You can jump really high. So if interest rates are low, then, you know, real estate stock prices are naturally inflated because that's where the money moves to. And then he was saying, you know, when interest rates are really high, it's like really high gravity and it's really hard for stock prices and real estate values to soar. Because they're just not as enticing. So that's really what he said about interest rates. But he said the question you have to ask yourself right now, because he was basically saying, you know, if interest rates stay at zero, then stocks right now look incredibly cheap. Yeah. And they should go up a lot more, which hearing that from Warren Buffett, I was like, wait, what the hell? What are you saying? Like, you're saying stocks look cheap. And yes, but if interest rates stay at zero, the question is, are interest rates going to stay
yes.
at zero? And the answer to that is obviously, no, they're not. But what's the time frame? Like, what's when are they no longer going to be at zero anymore? And the answer to that question is whenever the Fed decides to make that change, and that change will be forced by whether we see a lot of inflation, because the way that you stop inflation is by raising interest rates. Yeah. So that was the first thing. So do you have something to say on that?
Yeah. And I think that's a really interesting point. And Buffett has said that before, that, you know, if interest rates stay extremely low, then stocks are cheap. And I think that's important to understand, because stocks look expensive because, and when you say a stock looks expensive, you're saying that the return that it's offering is really low. But the returns the stocks are offering, even though the stock prices have gone up a lot, it might still be like low single digits or like mid single digits, which if interest rates are at zero, if the alternative is zero or 1%, then that's pretty good, right?
Yeah.
So it is an interesting point. I think it's really important to understand. But the other thing on the flip side of that, where Buffett goes into what will happen with interest rates, is historically, there's never been a period that's been extremely long, like more than a decade, where interest rates have been at zero. Because when interest rates are that low, people are spending a lot of money that's not theirs. And creates problems that that flow into other areas of the market.
Yep, they're exactly right. Money is very easy to come by, and it's like that by design. That's what they're trying to do, because they want people, like, they're giving people money to try and get them to spend it, stimulate the economy. You know, Joe Biden's announcing these infrastructure plans and whatever. So they're trying to put money into, you know, building stuff so that, you know, everything, the economy is stimulated, essentially. But yeah, that's really the question. And the question is, what happens with interest rates? Because, you know, if interest rates stay low forever, then it looks like stocks are cheap. If they start going up, then it's like, uh-oh. So they basically, one of the questions was to Buffett, Are you seeing inflation within Berkshire Hathaway? Because Berkshire Hathaway is a monster business that touches so many different industries that Buffett would actually have a really good insight into inflation just from his business operations, because they've got the boots on the ground. They're actually operating in all these different industries. So they use a lot of raw materials. So and Buffett noted that he is definitely seeing inflation within Berkshire Hathaway. So he talked about, and Greg Abel jumped on and spoke about this as well, through Berkshire's operations. Berkshire is experiencing inflation in a lot of raw materials, such as steel and lumber and petroleum and copper. And as such, they've had to raise their prices, or they've tried to raise their prices, and they've been able to get away with that. They've said they've not found any, you know, negative effects to them raising prices because people are, you know, so cashed up at the moment that people can pay for the, or people and businesses, they can pay for the increased prices. So he drew the example of like new house prices going up due to the increased cost of steel and lumber, and how they just raise their prices accordingly. I looked this up because I'm not like a economist or anything. Apparently, this is called cost push inflation, is where the cost of the underlying raw materials inflates. So therefore, for the business to maintain their margins and their profits, they raise their prices on the finished product or service.
Yeah.
So yeah, he noted that he's definitely seeing that within Berkshire Hathaway at the moment.
Yeah, and some other people will refer to this as supply side inflation, where the supply of goods, the cost of producing goods is going up, and that has to be passed on to the consumer. And it can actually be quite a scary way that inflation occurs, because if it does result in consumers spending less money, that then businesses are producing less, performing poorly, and then they lay people off and people lose their jobs, and it can quickly spiral into a recession whereby there's high inflation and there's a recession. So the government wants to provide stimulus, but they have to choose between adding more fuel to this inflationary fire or letting people suffer through a recession. It's like, which one do you choose? Like a really bad recession or really high inflation? And that's kind of where you get a stagflation environment, where you have high inflation but really low economic activity. It's something that Ray Dalio is quite concerned about, and he's spoken about it a number of times.
I remember him talking about that, because I remember that animation where you remember the lever where the interest rates are getting pulled down, but the lever bottoms out and they can't pull the interest rates down any further. And then they're like, uh-oh, we've lost our tool to control this.
And I mean, typically when there is high inflation, you want to raise interest rates. But if you're already in a recession, if people have already lost their jobs, the last thing that you want the Fed to do is to raise interest rates, make mortgage payments go up massively for people,
pressure on,
make more businesses go out of business because they have a ton of debt. But that's ultimately what will need to happen to reduce the inflation and get it back under control. It's exactly what happened in the 80s for the US and Australia. Both went through that tough decision where they had to decide, well, what do we do? Do we just raise interest rates? We bite the bullet and it'll cause a terrible recession, but we'll be able to get through it then and have low inflation again. No one really knows what we're going to see. We just have to kind of see it as it plays out. And a lot will ride on what the Fed decides to do.
Exactly.
And at the moment, it's been very much, we're going to do whatever it takes to get the economy back to where it needs to be. And maybe it'll be what Ray Dalio describes as a perfect deleveraging, where they're able to provide enough stimulus that people get back up and going, but not too much that it creates inflation. Historically, that's not really been the case.
And on that point, Buffett was saying, look, so far, it looks as though we've gotten away with what we've done. You know, we've printed a lot of money. We've put that money in the hands of people and in the hands of businesses. And so far, because inflation is still so low, it actually looks like we're getting away with it, which is fantastic, you know, because everybody feels better. It does stimulate the economy and we get back on track. But then in kind of a foreboding kind of way, he said, but that's the one thing with economics. You can never do one thing. You can't do one thing in economics. There's always a consequence. It's like a scale, right? You want to put a little bit more over here and it twists the scale. You know, one side goes up and the other side goes down. So he says there's always a consequence to things that you do in economics. So in a very roundabout way, he wasn't trying to dramatize it or anything, but he was just basically saying throughout the whole thing, just be prepared for a bit of a storm. And I mean, even with the other topics that he talked about, getting away from interest rates, I mean, you could just see, you can hear what he has to say and you can see his actions. I mean, he spoke about how he's holding a lot of money in cash. You know, he hasn't had any opportunities to deploy, how he's holding on to his cash position, and he actually doesn't think that the cash position, which is like, what, $140-50 billion, how he says he doesn't actually believe that's a huge amount of cash to be able to protect his business in a worst case scenario. So I'm like, okay. that's a little bit scary if he's saying something like that.
Yeah. I mean, we've got to remember, yes, we did have a recession and I'm not sure if we're out of a recession yet, but we're still, you know, very much in the midst of a recession. But a lot of the problems that were occurring in the economy before the pandemic have not been fixed. But leading up to the pandemic, when everyone was suggesting there might be some kind of collapse coming, that was because businesses were loaded up on debt and debt was extremely cheap and it was extremely risky. We're in this very precarious situation. That didn't go away because of the pandemic. In fact, governments loaded up on debt, businesses loaded up on debt, individuals loaded up on debt. So we're kind of in a situation where it's not as if, I'm sure a lot of people are thinking, oh, we've had our recession for our 5 to 8 year recession. So we can just, you know, invest in stocks and everything will be fine for the next few years. But I don't know if that's necessarily the case. I don't think we've had much of a period where businesses have actually had to save, a period where businesses have to go, okay, we can't take on any more debt. We actually have to cut back a little bit. We haven't seen that yet for an extended period of time. So I don't know. I'm not convinced that we're just going to have smooth sailing from here on in.
No, I'm not either. And I don't think Warren Buffett is convinced that it's going to be smooth sailing from what he was talking about. But that's kind of what he was talking about throughout. I think that was the main gist, the main gist of the Berkshire shareholder meeting. What else did he talk about here? Oh, yeah, that's right. He basically spoke about the difference between Berkshire and other businesses in a roundabout kind of way, kind of similar to what we were just talking about, what you're saying. Yeah, over the past 5 years, you know, most companies have been getting greedy, taking on debt, you know, doing massive buybacks. And he was basically, you know, without really bolstering their balance sheet, what they maybe should have been doing in a period of boom. And then Buffett thinks differently. You know, he stays disciplined. He builds up a sizable emergency fund. And, you know, last year he only did buybacks when the share price dipped like 30% last year. So he's in a much different boat, like what you're saying, where most businesses are just going a bit crazy. He's like, no. We want to position ourselves for the worst case scenario. And that's exactly what he's done. And if you know, it was to really start hailing in the economy and the stock market, then he'd be, you know, Berkshire would be in such a good position to do whatever they wanted to do.
Yeah.
Where else? What else should we talk? Oh, he spoke quickly about SPACs as well, which is kind of funny. But it was interesting relating it to Berkshire. I didn't really think about this, but of course it makes sense. He was saying that the popularity of SPACs is actually killing Berkshire's ability to acquire businesses. Because Warren basically said, if you get, you know, he was talking about the SPACs, if you get all of these investors' money and you get juicy fees if you spend their money, but you've got a limited time to spend their money, otherwise you have to give it back, then you're going to buy something. And you'll just buy it at a inflated price, because otherwise you have to give the money back, and you'd rather spend the money of your investors and collect their fees. So he was saying that that's leading a lot of business promising businesses to be bought out by these SPACs, and it just doesn't give, you know, Berkshire. He said, look, frankly, Berkshire is not competitive in that environment, which I found really interesting. Charlie said, I call it fee-driven buying. They're not buying because it's a great investment. They're buying because the advisor gets a fee.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting twist, because we've obviously spoken about SPACs a lot of different times, but I don't think we ever took that or thought about that perspective, that because of the two-year time horizon on a SPAC where they have to give the money back, they're going to buy. It's so true. They are going to buy something because they want to earn their fee. So they're more incentivized to make a bad investment than they are to just not make an investment at all, which is an interesting dynamic that I hadn't thought about.
Another, I hadn't thought about it either. But it makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, SPACs were bad enough without me thinking of it in that way, but just adds another thing.
Yeah. It's just more of the craziness in the market.
Yeah.
Speaking of craziness in the market, last thing I had to talk about, they only got one question on Bitcoin this year. I think everybody kind of knows what they're going to say about Bitcoin at this point.
Yeah.
It was pretty funny. They asked, you know, what do you think about cryptocurrency? That was basically the question. Buffett just said, you know, we've probably got hundreds of thousands of people watching this who own Bitcoin, and maybe two people that are short. So he's just going to pass on that question, which I found really funny. Then Charlie chimed in. Of course, Charlie chimed in with this. He said, I should say modestly that I think the whole damn development is disgusting and contrary to the interest of civilization, and I'll leave the criticism to others.
Oh, Charlie.
That's classic Charlie Munger, isn't it, right there?
Yeah.
Yeah, love that guy. But anyway, I think that's pretty much all there is to, well, that's not all there is to talk about the Berkshire, but I think that's probably where we'll leave it. They were the main points to come out of the of the meeting. So with that said, should we talk about some earnings or something? What should we talk about? Yeah,
we could talk about earnings. I've got Uber's earnings here that I don't think we've spoke. Maybe we have, but I don't know how many times we've spoken about Uber earnings, but it popped up and it looked very interesting. So I thought we could maybe talk about it. And there's maybe a bit of a discussion point at the end of the earnings about some things that are happening at Uber. So to get through some of their core numbers, first of all, so the top line number being gross bookings, which is before their revenue. This is just the total number delivery and Uber trips that they've done during the period. Yep. That hit $19.5 billion in the quarter, up 24% year over year. And 6.8 billion of that was driven by mobility, which is their normal normal Uber business.
Rides.
Yep. Mm. And that was down 38% year over year. So
yeah.
That's still hurting from last year. And delivery bookings came in at 12.5 billion, which was up 166% year over year. So that kind of makes perfect sense. Delivery is up in a big way. And people are taking Ubers to less places.
Yeah. I was going to say that. That is exactly what you would expect.
Yes. There's really nothing unique there. In terms of then revenue, so this is the fee, of course, that Uber collects from those gross bookings. That came in at $3.5 billion, which was up just 8% year over year. So not a big increase for what's been a really high growth company. Mobility revenue was $1.5 billion, which was down 41% year over year. And delivery revenue came in at $1.7 billion, which was up 230% year over year. So, again, nothing particularly strange about that.
So, this is Uber's cut, right?
Correct.
That's what we're talking about with revenue, because they don't even – well, they don't treat the drivers as employees, right?
No. So, the drivers are contractors.
In most places.
Correct. Yes. So the drivers are contractors, the driver's getting a cut, of course, and then Uber's getting their cut. And during this period, you can kind of work it out, I guess. So they're taking about 17.5% of the gross bookings came down as revenue.
Okay.
So that's kind of their fee.
Yeah.
And then, of course, they have other expenses that they need to pay beyond just paying the contractor. So, that's their fee. But in terms of their bottom line, the business continues to struggle to be anywhere near profitability, which we'll talk a little bit more about after. But in terms of the figure, their net loss for the period was $108 million, which was the closest they've been to profitability ever. The last quarter was like $1.5 billion loss or something.
Oh, wow. Okay.
However, if you look into what drove their net loss, they had a $1.6 billion gain from selling their self-driving business. So
they sold it.
They sold it. They're out. So I had a little bit of a dive into this because I wasn't really sure what Uber was doing. I knew they were doing something, but they had this business called Uber Advanced Technologies, and this was essentially Uber's attempt at making a robo-taxi network. So, doing a very similar thing to Waymo. I think they were using Volvo vehicles, and they were trying to build technology to allow these vehicles to be like a robo-taxi network.
Right.
Apparently, they had many safety problems. There was one accident that they cited, but I guess without knowing the details, you never really know how reliable that is. I mean, we just spoke about a Tesla accident that wasn't Tesla's fault at all.
Yeah.
Recently. But they cited many safety problems and it was losing a ton of money. And basically during the pandemic, they decided we're already losing a lot of money on our main business. We just can't afford to be expanding into this business that we really have no light at the end of the tunnel. We have no idea when when that would even work, if ever.
Yeah.
And when that would be allowed to be profitable, like allowed to generate revenue and be profitable. So they just had to cut that. But pretty funny that they had a $1.6 billion gain and they still lost. They sold a huge chunk of their business and they still lost money.
that is insane. But to be honest, reading that, I didn't even know that happened. I think, in all honesty, I think that seals Uber's fate for the long term. I think that now that they have openly said we are not pursuing self-driving robo-taxi network stuff, I think that literally has just confirmed that Uber will get put out of business by Tesla one day. I don't know when that'll be.
Yeah.
But I think that's almost, I would say in my mind, that is almost certain. One day, unless they do a massive pivot somehow and start doing something different or change their business model away from just providing the everyday Joe, essentially like taxi rides, unless they do something differently. But
yeah, you would imagine the company that has native robo-taxi software in a vehicle, that will be the business that will have the lowest cost and the most efficient setup.
Yeah,
like
absolutely.
I could still imagine you could have like a Tesla that can drive itself and there being some way to integrate Uber into it. I just can't imagine that setup would be able to pay drivers more than a native setup by something like Tesla where you own the vehicle and they can run it all from straight within the vehicle.
Well, you think about it, how much like a standard Uber ride might be something like $20. Tesla is aiming to do like a standard ride for something like $2 or $3. Mm. I mean, of course, if it's safer, you don't have to, first of all, you don't have to interact with the driver. Secondly, it's safer. Well, it will be eventually. It already kind of is, but when it comes out, it definitely will be. And it's like $3 or $5 instead of $20 or $30. Then it's like, it's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
It's a no-brainer.
Yeah. I mean, as sad as it is to kind of say this, the last bottleneck in this business is the driver.
Yeah.
If the driver is the most expensive part, the driver and the company's fee.
Yeah.
That's the two most expensive parts. So, that's
get rid of the driver.
That's where it's going over the long term.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, there's a little bit more I want to talk about that specifically. So I'll just get through the other numbers. But in terms of loss from operations, they had a loss of $1.3 billion. So that's really their real loss of their business, which is massive considering they only brought in $3.5 billion. Basically, the company is just under a lot of pressure at the moment. There's not much is going right. As I mentioned, they sold their self-driving business to get some money back. They have a shortage of drivers at the moment. So, they currently have 3.5 million drivers, but that figure is down 22% from last year. And the problem with having a lack of drivers is, of course, Uber has surcharges for when there's not many drivers around. So, if there's less drivers, the cost goes up to consumers, and that makes it a worse product for consumers. And it means people are more likely to move over to something like a DD or even to take a taxi. So, big problem at the moment is that they don't have enough people driving for them. And they're also planning, they said this last month, that they're planning on spending $250 million of their own stimulus to try and attract drivers to rejoin. So, I presume that would come in the form of providing them a short period if you sign up whereby you would earn more than normal or something like that. Or maybe it's money to help people repair a vehicle or something. Like, I'm not exactly sure where that fund goes, but they're planning on spending quite a lot of money on attracting drivers back, and they have to because that's their business at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely.
But not only that, they're also facing a massive problem right now, which is in the UK, they recently ruled that Uber must classify their drivers as employees, as workers and not contractors, which has been a massive story in the US at the moment. But the UK has gone through and ruled, the court has ruled that.
Yeah.
And that means that Uber, now not only do they have to have a driver because they don't have a robot network, but they have to pay the Uber drivers a minimum wage. They have to set working hours. They have to provide benefits such as annual leave and sick leave, and in some cases, healthcare and employee unemployment insurance and a bunch of other things.
Damn.
Yeah,
that hurts, doesn't it? And that's the thing, is that it's like the domino effect. Once it happens, it happened, what, in California, was it? I think that's what we're talking about. Is that what we're talking about?
I'm not sure if it was months and months. Yeah, I'm not sure.
Maybe it didn't pass.
Actually, I think it did. And I think Uber and Lyft were challenging it. So, it's not in effect yet.
Right.
But I think it's still going through the courts. Yeah.
But it's so interesting that once there's an example of something, then it just triggers the next example of the, you know, now it's the UK. And where will it be next? Australia or somewhere else, you know?
Yeah.
It's like once, it, you know, it's kind of like the flow and effect. Once one place legal or one state legalizes marijuana use, then the next state does. And the more states that do, then the more it becomes normal and the more pressure it is. And it just keeps going like that. And then it won't be, I wouldn't imagine it would be too long before most places would have that legalized kind of thing. It's just that kind of domino effect, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is a worrying sign for Uber.
Definitely. I mean, it's a big concern. If obviously the UK is a smaller part of their business, but if the US decides to do something similar, then you know, they're not even profitable.
That would be curtains.
It's almost the end of you would imagine it's almost the end of Uber. What are your thoughts on this? Do you think that, I mean, in terms of in terms of having contracted drivers or employee drivers, do you think that Uber should be allowed to have contractors?
Well, like this is my viewpoint on this specific situation. The first point is that I definitely want people that are working to be treated fairly. So that's like top of the list. Is I want, you know, if people are working and they are being, you know, really beaten down by these, you know, whatever cut Uber takes and not getting enough work, or then that sucks and something needs to be done about that. But in the case of Uber, I mean, Uber's an app, and people sign up for the app. So it's not like, you know, Uber's going out there. We're now, you know, hiring drivers, come in for an interview and we'll give you a job. It's kind of just people, and for a lot of people, Uber's not their main gig, it's their second gig. So for people, they're actually like, oh, look, I can try and sign up for this app and then go and make my own money. So in that kind of instance, I'm kind of like, Uber is just the platform. And then if they have, I mean, ultimately, it doesn't really matter, because if Uber has a good enough option for people to go and work as an Uber driver and make money, then it should all work out. But naturally, yeah, if they don't have a good enough option, if workers are just not earning a lot of money, or, you know, they're getting squeezed and it's just a bad experience for them, then naturally people will not want to work for Uber unless they have no other choice. So I think that's where it gets a little bit depressing, is when, like, personally, I don't believe if Uber's just opening up the platform and saying, hey, you can do this if you want, then I don't believe that they need to classify the drivers as employees. But the bit that is unfortunate is where, you know, maybe for some people, Uber is their only option. Like, they got laid off from their job. They're not employed at the moment. So they're like, crap, I know that people do this Uber thing for a living and they can make some money. I guess I've just got to give that a shot, because I need money, and they offer a service where I can just sign up and get going.
Yeah.
So in that sense, it's like, yeah, that is very sad. But generally speaking, I'm like, well, Uber's just the app. They just make the app and they offer something for people, and if that offer is good enough, then they will get drivers to join up. But if it's not, then people will not join up.
Yeah. I mean, the main thing I think about is, if, say, the US does decide that they have to call them employees, if the economics of that doesn't make sense for Uber, I mean, if it just doesn't make them profitable, which they're not profitable now, so it obviously doesn't make any sense, but if that finishes them off, then those jobs don't even exist. So, I don't know. To me, it's like a question of, would I rather have Uber as an option and know you're not going to be able to drive Uber full time and make enough money to just do that full time.
Yeah.
But would I rather have that as an option, as an extra side job, or that the job just doesn't exist because because the bar's been like lifted in a way whereby they have to pay a minimum wage. They have to, it can't be just contracted.
They can't offer it. Yeah.
So that's kind of the question. I don't know what the answer to that is. I mean, clearly the fact that there's less drivers coming back to Uber means that Uber probably, regardless of what happens with the employee thing, they need to be probably taking a smaller fee and just trying to attract more drivers back. And I think that's what they're trying to do with this stimulus, this one-time stimulus. But, yeah, I mean, the economics barely work, even with them as contractors, which is why the robo-taxi thing is such an obvious next step. I think Uber's finished. Yeah, Uber's finished if they have to classify them as employees. I don't think that we will see a case where they classify them as employees and then all of the Uber drivers just get paid more. I don't think that's going to happen. It'll either be they get classified as employees and a ton of people will stop using Uber because prices will go up and there'll be less need for drivers. So there'll be less jobs there for people who Uber drive, or Uber will just be done.
Yeah.
And there'll be none.
Or place by place, Uber will just pull their operations from that place.
Yeah.
Like, all right, we have to classify in this state or this country, we have to classify them as employees. I guess we got to shut down operations and try and shift it to another country that doesn't have that rule.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it's one thing to change rules to better employees' situations in a company that is massively profitable. It's another thing to do it for a company, an industry, let's say, where every company is not profitable. Like, it doesn't really make any sense to me. Like, no one who's doing ride sharing is profitable. There's no company that's profitable. So it doesn't really, it's like, it's not a case where you have a company doing extremely well, shareholders are getting compensated massively for their good job of whatever, providing capital, and then the employees are just like starving. Like, that's something to like look at and say, well, okay, well, what kind of bullying is this company doing to make such massive profits and treat their employees terribly? But that's, I don't know if that's what's happening with Uber. I don't think it is. I mean, they're not making any money, so.
Yeah. I don't know. It's interesting. Who knows which way it'll go, but yeah, this will, whatever happens to Uber will be a very interesting story.
Yeah.
To follow. All right. What should we talk about next? What have you got here about the some federal judge overturning something?
Yeah. So this happened in the US in regards to an eviction ban that was put in place last year, and This is kind of interesting. It kind of raises some questions about some things we're talking about with inflation and stimulus before during the Berkshire thing. But just to give a bit of a background. So last year, the CDC, which is what, the Center of Disease Control or something like that in the US, they basically used their power to enforce a ban on most housing evictions in September of last year. So that basically meant that the CDC said, if you're a landlord and you have people renting in your houses, you can't evict them, even if they don't pay. And that was put in place in September. And of course, the reason why was because a lot of people were just out of work and they wanted people to stay home. They wanted people to stay in their homes and try and isolate so that the spread of the virus would go down. And as a result, they kind of protected renters in that way, meaning they couldn't be evicted. And this ban was expected to go until January. That's like the period that they set it for. Then Biden in January extended it to April. And then again in April, he extended it to June. So it's been extended twice now. And what are we in? We're in April or we're in May at the moment. So I don't know how many months that is from September, but over 6 months, I think, in which this this ban has been in place. A little bit of information around why the ban was in place. Apparently, one in five renters at the time were struggling to make payments. So you had a huge number of people that, if this wasn't put in place, they would have been evicted.
They're on the street.
It wasn't some small number of people like a normal year where people just miss their payments or they overextend themselves and or whatever it is, lose their job or whatever it is. But a huge amount of Americans would have been evicted. And it would have been a huge problem. But what happened this week was a federal judge in Colombia ruled against this new law. So the judge basically said, nah, you're not doing it anymore. you've extended it too many times. And basically the argument was that it was a law that unfairly forced landlords to provide free housing, which is
pretty much
what's been happening to people who have had a house and have had people renting in it and not paying not paying their lease for the past few months. So the Department of Justice immediately initiated an appeal. So the law actually hasn't been removed yet. The law stays in place while they go through their appeal process. And it is kind of interesting. I just wanted to hear your thoughts on this. So the two sides of this really are, and look, I don't think there's any right answer here, but the two sides are, some are, of course, arguing that the law is necessary to stop the displacement of many Americans, to prevent people from having to leave their house, first of all, but then also to do unnecessary movement around America, you know, to look for a new house. And that, of course, could exacerbate the spread of the virus. And they had some data on places that had high evictions. And there was a correlation between a high number of COVID cases and the evictions there as well. So they had some data to support that. And then on the other side, you have people arguing, and this is of course why landlords would argue that it's not their responsibility as an individual homeowner to provide stimulus to other people in that, you know, if the US wanted to prevent people from being evicted, then the US could provide direct relief. They could provide stimulus to people and say, hey, use this money to pay your rent, or the government could pay the landlord. But in this case, you have the landlords just not getting any money. It's just that the landlords are actually paying the stimulus in a way.
My line of thinking is very similar to your line of thinking. You can see both sides. I mean, it's really sad if people, you know, can't, for whatever reason, they've lost their job, whatever, can't make their housing payments and you know, facing eviction. But at the same time, I mean, you take the landlord's perspective and they've bought that house as an investment to try and, you know, generate cash. And, you know, part of the agreement is that if you live in that house, you pay your rent. And if you can't do that, then you need to, or if you stop doing that, then you need to move on. And that's the law around the world. And that's fair. But it's pretty brutal, you know, because so many people are facing such financial hardship if they just get, you know, sorry, you're not making any payments, and toss you out on the street. You know, see ya, bye. Sorry, not my fault, not my problem. But yeah, I can understand the government putting in some sort of thing where it's just like, okay, you, at this current point in time, for a very short period of time, you can't just kick them out because that would just be brutal. Yeah. And we, you know, virus had spread and blah, blah, blah. But yes, I am definitely on your line of thinking there, where you say it's not the landlord's fault. They shouldn't have to foot the bill here. If the government is saying, no, you can't kick them out, that's not fair, then the government should be the one making the payments for, instead of just handing people just cash where they can spend it on whatever they want. You know, if you're in, what instead of just giving you $1,400, instead maybe pay $1,400 worth of rent. You know, I think that's a much smarter way. I mean, if the government's going to go, no, you can't kick them out, then it's like, all right, well, are you going to pay me for the losses I'm now yeah. copping for on this investment property that I've got? Yeah, that's right. You better, because you're the ones that are. It's effectively the US government is now just saying, landlords, cop it.
Yeah.
We are going to absolutely make you cop it. And it's like, well, hang on, that's not very fair.
Yeah. I mean, what you just kind of explained before about the way to go about it is kind of like the job keeper thing that we had in Australia, whereby we didn't want a lot of workplaces to be just laying off employees because because they had no business. So the government basically said, we'll pay for you to keep employees on the books.
Exactly.
And that kind of makes sense. A different analogy that I thought of before was, it would be pretty weird if a law was passed where they just said, hey, you don't have to pay groceries for 6 months. Oh, and also the grocery store just has to cop it. Like, we're not going to, that would be ridiculous. Obviously it's okay. It would kind of be logical for the government to say, here's some money for groceries. Like, because, you know, everyone's struggling or a lot of people are struggling, but it would be so weird for the grocery store just to be like, what? So people just have to,
exactly.
We just have to foot the bill for this.
Exactly.
I never thought of it that way. I think it was good that they probably implemented something like this quickly, just a bit of a band-aid fix, just to prevent a lot of people being displaced. But
yeah,
it does kind of seem strange. And I mean, the reason why they've done it in this way and not just provided stimulus is, of course, because it would cost a huge amount of money. I mean, if you just think of maybe 10 to 50 million Americans the government having to pay rent for 10 to 50 million Americans. I mean, if you do that, you expand that over 6-12 months, you're talking about maybe $100 billion, maybe even more than that. So, that's why they don't want to do it, but yeah, it is an interesting situation. And it's another one of those cases where no one really knows what's the right thing to do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Should we leave that there and go into some Q&A?
Yeah. We should probably have some.
This is actually interesting. This first one I just see here is very related to what we were just talking about. This person wants us to talk about, you know, the recent US stimulus checks. They ask, you know, does it truly benefit the economy in the short term? And are there negative consequences in the long term? Are there better alternatives? And I think that relates back to what we were just talking about, is that, you know, what was it? Ray Dalio was talking about, he said something like the governments are trying to get money into a lot of money into the hands of people in a huge, you know, kind of effective way, but they just want to try and get it done. So I think, you know, I'm not sure exactly the stats of whether it does benefit the economy in the short term. It certainly provides financial relief in the short term, but I think that there probably are, my personal opinion is that there probably are better ways to going about stimulus than simply handing money to people. Because really what you want, if you're doing stimulus, is you want that money to be spent. I mean, most people probably do just turn around and spend it on something, but you do want that money to get chucked back into the economy. So I kind of like that idea, what we're talking about before, where it's kind of like, do we provide relief in the form of food vouchers and rent vouchers, as opposed to just handing you $1,400 where you could, you know, you don't even have to put that in the economy. You can just go put it into some sort of stock if you wanted to, something like that.
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts there?
I mean, I think it just depends, and we don't really know the outcome of this until afterwards, but it just depends on how people spend the money.
Exactly.
Really, the reason why you would do a massive amount of stimulus immediately is because you want spending habits to stay the same as they were before, as they were before there was any problem. You want people to feel comfortable spending money on, first of all, things they need to live, but also on other things so that those businesses don't have to lay people off. Even if it's discretionary purchases, things that are not necessary, you want people to still spend money on things so that those businesses thrive and then they still have employees. And you kind of just want to patch things up for a little while until things can kind of fix themselves and kind of get back onto into normal places. But yeah, it really depends on how people spend the money. If people are just throwing it at the stock market in high valuation businesses, that's just money just disappearing, right?
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
That's just money that just basically stacks on top of some rich person's net worth, or like a lot of people's net worth, but like for the most part, that's where it's going to be funneling, and it doesn't add any value to the business. The business is overvalued, so it doesn't add anything to them. That is like the worst use of money right now. It would be money going into overvalued businesses, not all investments, but overvalued ones for sure. Whereas, in a way, you kind of want spending in the short term. You want people to spend the money. Long term, you want investment. But right now, you want people to spend money as if they were like in a normal economic condition. So, but we'll just see what happens. I mean, it's impossible to know. And I think you're right. I think there are ways that you can do like calculated stimulus that's probably better than just providing money. So, doing things that incentivize behaviors that we know have good outcomes, so people incentivizing people to get jobs or to keep their original job, or things like that. So
I think that's right. I think the one thing that could have been improved, I don't think it's smart to simply give, just to straight up give money to someone, because it can, like what we were just saying, it can be spent on literally anything. You want to think about how do we incentivize these specific behaviors that we want to see. Or maybe they just say, you know what, most people aren't investors. Most people don't have brokerage accounts. Maybe we should just give them the money. They're going to spend it. I don't know.
Yeah.
Who knows? I'm trying to scroll through these questions. Should we do one more or maybe just close it out there?
Yeah, I reckon let's do one more quick one.
Do one more.
Hey, here's one, and then we'll do one more after this. Hey, Brandon, do you speak Dutch? You have a very Dutch name.
I do have a very Dutch name, but I do not speak Dutch. I am very much Australian, born and bred. As are my parents. My grandparents on my dad's side are from the Netherlands. Interesting little fact is that people from the Netherlands do not call themselves Dutch.
Oh.
Dutch was a name that was put onto them. Did you know about that?
Wow.
Most people don't know that. The people from the Netherlands call themselves Nederlander.
Wow.
So there you go.
There you go. Brandon's just lying, by the way. He's a bit shy. As soon as the podcast goes off, we speak fluent Dutch.
We speak
together.
Fluent Dutch. Yeah.
Sometimes Russian. You know, we just change it up. Depends on the day.
Oh, we mix it up. Yeah. German. Do you want to speak German today?
Brushing
up on your German?
Yeah. We'll do a little bit. Yeah.
All right. Cool. Yeah, nice. Okay. All right. I'm trying to find one more. Let's do. Let's do this one. Hi, I'm a passive investor and only invest in ETFs such as the S&P 500. I was wondering, since the share price fluctuates according to the market, is it still okay to be investing in it on a weekly or monthly basis?
Yes, it's okay. In fact, it's encouraged.
It is encouraged, and it is definitely okay, because remember, you are a passive investor, so you actually don't care about the month-to-month price.
Yeah, exactly right. And I mean, there's a couple of school of thoughts here. One is the dollar cost average method, whereby if you're investing frequently, you're going to get closer to the actual movement of the market. Because if you just excluded costs, for example, let's say you didn't have to pay any cost to invest, then ideally you would want to invest like every single day, because then you would perfectly track the market, right? Because you would your portfolio return would be pretty much the exact chart of the market. Whereas if you buy once a year, it will vary from that. Now, over the very long term, other people will argue that it really doesn't matter if you bought on the worst day of the year or the best day of the year. The difference is extremely small. But I think it's a good practice to invest consistently. And it really means that you're going to be a lot less emotional about the market. If you invest once a year, and I've found this for myself in the past, if you invest once a year and the market has just gone up a bunch or it's gone down a bunch, it can influence you as to when you want to put that money in. Whereas if you just have the practice of every week, every month, or every 2 months, or whatever it is, then you're less emotional about it. It's just like, oh, there's my calendar notification, bye. And then you do it again the next month.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. No, I agree with you. Yeah, I think, you know, active investing and market tracking index funds, they just don't work well with me. So if I'm holding ETFs, I'm always a passive investor. So I am thinking about dollar cost averaging. And yeah, you're right. You would want to do it every single day if you could, but the costs of investing prevent you. You have to pay brokerage costs every time. So for me, I find like most people do it quarterly or, you know, every 6 months. You just keep investing and you don't worry about the price fluctuations, because if you're passive investing, you know that you're holding for a very long time. If you're a passive investor, you're not holding for a year or two. You're holding for like a couple of decades, because that's how you need that time for the dollar cost averaging approach to play out, for the market to go up at you know, to get, how do I say it? The longer that you hold, the more likely it is that you'll average out to that 7-8% return of the market.
Yeah.
The shorter your investing time frame, the less likely you are going to hit that. You might get way more, you might get way less, but it's less likely that you're going to hit that average.
Yeah, well put. Should we, we'll leave it there for today.
Yeah, let's wrap things up.
Yeah, thanks everyone for tuning in as always. And of course, we'll be answering some more questions next week at the end of next week's episode. So if you want to ask a question, you can by heading over to the YouTube version of the podcast at youtube.com/TheYoungInvestorsPodcast. Or you can just search it on YouTube and click on the latest episode and just leave your questions or topics or anything at all there, feedback or anything as a comment on the latest episode. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. Thanks, ShareSite, for sponsoring. As always, get 4 months off a yearly subscription if you want using the link sharesite.com/younginvestors. Thanks, Brandon, for joining me as always.
No stress, my friend. And that was good fun. We spoke a lot about a lot of different topics today.
Yeah.
So that was good. We had a lot to talk about. We still didn't cover everything we wanted to.
Yeah.
But yeah. No, thanks, guys, for listening. We very much appreciate it. And we'll see you guys next week.
See you guys.